From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. The Earth's population has grown rapidly in the last two centuries. Are we dangerously close to exceeding the limits of the Earth's resources? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with biologist Joel Cohen, author of the book, How Many People Can the Earth Support? Also, the jazz world is mourning the loss of one of its great improvisers, saxophonist Jerry Mulligan. He died Saturday at the age of 68. We'll remember Mulligan with a 1989 interview. Working with Gil Evans and Miles Davis, Mulligan helped launch the era of cool jazz. And Steven Weinberg reviews the new film, Georgia. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, this news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. It was 23 years ago today that the Supreme Court announced its decision in the case of Roe v. Wade. Its opinion was that states could not outlaw abortion in the first 3 months of pregnancy, that a woman's right to privacy outweighed any state interest in protecting the fetus. Thousands of people who disagree with that opinion gathered in Washington to mark the anniversary. Wanda Franz of the National Right to Life Committee said public opinion is turning against abortion rights.
Although the proponents of legalized abortion have tried to hide it, the truth about abortion is slowly coming out. It is clear that more and more people are uncomfortable with abortion on demand, and many are learning the facts about abortion.
Franz spoke at a news conference today. Abortion rights activists held their own events at a news conference held by the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. President Kate Michelman worried that many state legislatures have passed laws designed to keep women from exercising their constitutional right to an abortion.
Supporters of these laws demonstrate their contempt for women's reproductive decision-making by using the force of government to place formidable obstacles in the path of women needing an abortion. Mandatory waiting periods are now longer. Judicial bypass requirements for minors are more stringent, and biased counseling laws are more onerous than ever before.
Michelman said those laws are designed to confuse, delay, and coerce women into bearing unwanted children. At least 32 people have died in the last few days because of floods. About half of those deaths occurred in Pennsylvania. President Clinton has declared 25 Pennsylvania counties federal disaster areas. The First Lady is offering to submit to questions by the Senate Whitewater Committee if she can take the questions in writing and answer them in writing. UPI's Bill Small reports.
The offer comes in a letter from the Clintons' private attorney, David Kendall, to New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato. In it, Kendall notes that the Senate Whitewater Committee may be reaching a point when it will be submitting written questions to First Lady Hillary Clinton, and Kendall invites the committee to proceed with that idea. He says Mrs. Clinton has responded to written questions from the committee in the past and is willing to do so again in an effort to bring the committee's inquiry to a conclusion. The offer comes the day after the White House chief of staff said the committee's inquiry is coming dangerously close to political harassment of the First Lady, and Senator D'Amato insisted his committee is only trying to establish facts and not bully Mrs. Clinton. Bill Small at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 8.31 points at 5192.63 in heavy trading of 307 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 8.27 points at 1026.72. This is National Public Radio News. Yesterday, House Majority Leader Richard Armey said the Republicans want certain conditions met in order to raise the federal debt ceiling. Today, White House spokesman Mike McCurry said the House Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader ought to repudiate that position. McCurry called Armey's remarks dangerous. Russian President Boris Yeltsin said today he'll probably run for re-election in June. He's to announce his final decision next month. According to the Interfax news agency, Yeltsin acknowledged that winning won't be easy. Mexico City today is under the most severe anti-smog restriction ever implemented there. A lingering thermal inversion has pushed ozone levels dangerously high. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
A bank of cold air stationed for the past week above the city of 20 million has trapped so much pollution at ground levels that authorities have taken the most drastic steps ever to keep the sea of smog from getting worse. Half the city's 3 million private cars are not being allowed to circulate on the city's streets based on license plate numbers. Should the thermal inversion continue tomorrow, the measure will affect the other half of the car fleet. This kind of vehicle restriction was in effect for the first time ever over the weekend, but the measure did nothing to improve the air. Winds needed to push the smog out failed to materialize. Also, about a fifth of the city's gasoline stations are closed today to cut down on leaking gasoline vapors. And 600 of the city's most polluting factories are being forced to cut production by up to 40%. I'm David Wallner in Mexico City.
French authorities have slapped a $200 fine on a cosmetics maker for not labeling its products in French. This is the first punishment to come out of the law passed in 1994 that says that all foreign products imported into France must have its labels translated into French. A spokesman for The Body Shop said the company was trying to comply, but that translating all those labels takes time. I'm Noor Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, in for Terry Gross. The world's population is currently 5.7 billion, and the question that keeps population experts busy is, how many people is too many? Joel Cohen is head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University, and the answer, he says, depends. He says a far more compelling question is, how do people want to live? Or what kind of material goods do they want? Or what do they want to eat? How do they want to use the world's natural resources? And how do they want society to be organized? Cohen says that once we have the answers to those questions, we'll know how big a population the Earth can sustain. Cohen explores these questions and more in his new book, How Many People Can the Earth Support? Cohen is a population biologist and was a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation award. He says there has been rapid growth in the population in the last two centuries because of decreases in infant mortality and increases in life expectancy. I asked Joel Cohen to give us a feel for how fast the population is growing today.
It's growing about 1.5% per year, which is enough to double the population in about 43 years if that rate were to continue into the future. That is a rate of growth that is historically unprecedented. Never before the second half of the 20th century had any human being lived through a doubling of global population. And yet now there are people alive, those who were born in 1920, for example, who have lived through a tripling. But anybody on the planet who is 40 years old or older has lived through a doubling of the Earth's population, and that never, ever happened before the second half of the 20th century.
Why such a high rate of growth in the second half of the 20th century?
Well, there was sort of a running start in the middle of the 18th century, but there was a tremendous revolution after World War II when the rich countries of the world learned how to export health without exporting wealth. And at the end of World War II, cheap public health measures like spraying insecticides against malaria, screening windows, vaccinating babies, environmental modifications, medical changes, nutritional improvements, public health measures spread around the world to the poor countries. And basically, instead of dying like flies, people started surviving at rates that were without historical precedent. As death rates dropped, birth rates around the world remained high. They had been high to make up for the high death rates of the past, but the birth rates did not drop as rapidly as the death rates, and so the consequence was that the population grew extremely rapidly.
I wonder, looking back over the last couple of centuries, what role things like plagues have had in keeping the population down, and what effect you think it has today?
Well, infectious diseases have always played a major role in human populations. When the glaciers retreated from most of the northern hemisphere about 10,000 years ago, people invented agriculture and began to live in settled places. A consequence of that was that they were living in their own wastes and in the wastes of the animals that they had domesticated and kept around them. And so as the food supply provided by population, by agriculture increased the population, the concentration of wastes around that population went up, and people suddenly found themselves with new and strange diseases. And one British epidemiologist and historian named Thomas McCune hypothesized that in the 18th century, people in the old world, that is Europe, were improving their nutrition as a result of New World foods that had been brought back from the New World. And the improvement in nutrition reduced the vulnerability of those people, Europeans, to infectious diseases. And the drop in infectious diseases started the modern rise of population in the 18th century. That was just a small surge compared to what came after World War II, when the reduction in malaria and other diseases caused a huge surge in population growth.
Do you see, then, AIDS playing the same kind of role today that plagues in the past have played in keeping population down?
Well, the truth is nobody knows what will be the demographic impact of AIDS. When a workshop was held in New York in 1989 that brought together eight different groups of modelers to try to get an answer to this question, the answers that they gave for the impact of AIDS on population growth rates were all over the place. Nevertheless, UN administrators need to have an answer, and so they made a set of assumptions. Whether these assumptions are realistic, I wouldn't swear. But I can tell you what they calculated. They said, in 1994, a United Nations report on 15 countries in Central Africa where AIDS is most prevalent estimated that by 2005, the population growth rate there would be 2.88% per year because of AIDS, but without AIDS, it would be 3.13% per year. What that means is that AIDS would have slowed the doubling time of these 15 Central African nations from 24 years to double to 22 years. So if these projections are to be believed, AIDS will have much less effect than high fertility on Central Africa's population growth rate during the coming decades.
Joel Cohen is our guest, and he's the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and author of a new book called How Many People Can the Earth Support? Let's talk a little bit about food production and food distribution. What kinds of technological advances, then, have made food more accessible to populations around the world, and let's say even compared to a generation or several generations ago? Has food production improved?
Worldwide, food production has improved, and it has improved in all continents except Africa, where food production has grown, but not as rapidly in recent decades as the population has grown. The growth of worldwide food production is a result of several factors. Everybody has heard about the Green Revolution, and that was an introduction of not only new breeds of crops, not only new breeds of rice and wheat and corn, but of a whole battery of associated supports like fertilizers, new tillage methods, new irrigation methods, in fact, new systems of land management, consolidation of small holdings into larger holdings, and systems of credit that made it possible for people to buy the high-tech seeds and plant them and buy fertilizer. So there was really a social revolution behind the plant aspect of the Green Revolution, and that revolution brought about a tremendous increase in food production in some countries, particularly for those people who held large plots of land.
So if the question is how many people can the planet sustain, we don't, as you said, the answer to that is not clear. But at the same time, if food is one of the important ingredients in figuring out the answer to that. The truth of the matter is that we can grow lots more food. Are you saying that?
Yes, we definitely can grow much more food than we're growing. In fact, there was a study done at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Luxembourg, Austria, that estimated that the developing regions, excluding China, could, with the soil that they have and the water resources that they have, if they had high inputs of fertilizers and high technology, they could grow enough food to nourish several times the total population of the Earth today. Now, let's make allowances for that being, rough and ready calculation and their environmental consequences and also all kinds of things like that. Nevertheless, it does seem possible that with sufficient industrial inputs to the agricultural system, much more food could be grown than is being grown today.
Now, let's look at water for a moment. And I don't know, I think of this as a much more finite natural resource. But if we're talking about how many people the Earth can feed, you have to think about water as well. Does that, what answers do we have for how much water and how it's distributed as well?
Well, there's a lot of water. 97.5% of it is salt water, so we can immediately ignore all that for agricultural use unless somebody invents a variety of wheat or rice that is happy to grow in salt water, and people are working on that. Mm. But fresh water, there's a lot of fresh water. The annual fall of fresh water is something like 113,000 cubic kilometers. That's quite a bit of water. The real problem is it's in the wrong place at the wrong time. So a lot of it runs unused into the sea, whereas other places are flat, can't store water, don't get enough of it in the first place. We use water basically for three things, for agriculture, for industry, and for domestic and personal use. The domestic and personal use, washing yourself, washing your car, drinking, going to the toilet and things like that, very small. Depending on the country, agricultural use may be anywhere from 25% in a highly industrial country to 80 or 90% in a primarily agricultural country. There's tremendous variation in how efficiently different countries use agricultural water. For example, let's compare Israel and Somalia. Israel has about half the water supply per person of Somalia. They both have very little water, but Israel has invented drip irrigation technology where a computer controls when each drop of water is delivered by a pipe to a plant that needs water then. And so they are able to grow crops and sell them to European markets. Somalia, with more water, isn't able to manage the little it has with the same sophistication, and their agricultural product is much smaller. So there's a lot of room for intelligence in managing the water we have, and there's a tremendous amount of waste of water, both in this country and abroad, for inefficient agricultural use.
And our guest today on Fresh Air is Joel Cohen. And he is the head of the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University and the author of a new book on How Many People Can the Earth Support? We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joel Cohen, and his book is called How Many People Can the Earth Support? Let's focus, if we can, on fertility. And there are currently 5.7 billion people in the world today. And I know from our conversation, you've said it's hard to predict how many actual people the Earth can support. But what do you think those outer limit numbers are?
I can tell you that in the last half century, people have said the Earth can't support more than 1 billion people at an acceptable level of living. And other people have said, oh, yes, the Earth can support at least 1,000 billion or 1 trillion people at acceptable levels of living. So I collected as many estimates as I could and analyzed them, and I found that about half of these estimates lie somewhere between 4 and 16 billion. So most scholars give you a range between 4 billion and 16 or 20 billion.
Where do you come down on that continuum?
I come down on the continuum that the question has to be amplified and does not have a simple numerical answer at all. Why do I say that? Because how many people the Earth can support depends on choices that will be made by my children and your children and their children. It depends on how they wish to live. Are they going to wear cotton or are they going to wear nylon? Are they going to wear rayon? Are they going to eat meat or are they going to eat vegetables? Are they going to drive around in private cars or are they going to use mass transit? Are we going to have drip irrigation or are we going to have wasteful irrigation? Are we going to settle our conflicts by bombing our opponents into oblivion, or are we going to settle our conflicts by negotiating? Are we going to take the route of Yugoslavia or Czechoslovakia? These are the things that determine the availability of resources and the quality of life. And without knowing what those human choices will be in the future, it is ridiculous to talk about a single fixed number.
Is it important, though, to focus on family planning and to give men and women the kinds of choices that they can have then the size of family that they want?
I believe it's very important to focus on family planning, though not exclusively. And why do I say that? If I were driving a big truck in the dark on a foggy road that I had never seen before, and there might be rock slides on the road, and I didn't have any headlights, I would go slow, right? Well, the planet is on a dark road where we can't see the future. Our headlights are inadequate because we don't have good enough science. And we're going faster than we've ever gone before. We're doubling in 40 years, 43 years at the present. We're going with unprecedented speed. We can't adapt to changes as easily with this high growth rate as we could if we had a lower growth rate. So I think it is tremendously important to give people the means to control their own fertility easily. But that's not the only thing we have to do.
Well, if the idea is then to bring some kind of choice into these family planning issues, is it more important to address the concerns and lives of women than men to get the maximum results?
Well, there's certainly a very good case for giving more attention to women than we have given them. Women, of the roughly 1 billion illiterates on the planet, women are about two-thirds. At every level of education, women are discriminated against in most countries in the world, not all, but in almost every. Women get about one-third of the income and do about two-thirds of the work in the world. And women have restricted rights, legal rights, in very large parts of the world. In the Islamic world, they have half of the inheritance rights. They must have the permission of their husband to leave the home. There are lots of restrictions in many different cultures on the rights of women. And as a matter of human justice and equity, women ought to have more invested in them than we are currently investing. So I think that's very, very important. On the other hand, it takes two to tango. And men in many countries, including the United States, need to have a greater sense of their role in reproduction and of their responsibilities in reproduction. So I think leaving the men out of the picture would be a big mistake.
I'm curious that if everyone in the world today had only the number of children to replace themselves, I guess that's called zero population growth, how long would it take for the Earth's population to stabilize?
About 70 years, a long time. And the reason for that is that 32% of all the people in the world today are under the age of 15, so roughly one out of three. If those people have the 2.1 children that they're entitled to for replacement level, they will add several billion to the Earth's population. And there are other young people who haven't had their 2.1. So stopping population growth is like stopping a very long train or an ocean liner. There's a tremendous amount of momentum moving it forward, and it's really quite necessary to realize that it takes decades and decades. Therefore, if we want to deal with a coming half century, we got to start doing it today.
So you see that as a good worldwide goal?
I do see it as an important goal, and I think the time to pay attention to it is now. Let me just mention that the world spends for family planning services in the developing countries about $5 billion a year. That's roughly a dollar per person per year. Hmm. For comparison, what do we spend on NASA? The United States alone spends $14 billion. What do we spend in the United States alone on pet food and pet care? $17 billion. 3.5 times what we spend as a world on family planning services and supplies. So there's room for consideration whether we're allocating our resources in the way that we ought to.
Well, I thank you, Joel Cohen, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Enjoyed it.
Joel Cohen is a population biologist and heads the Laboratory of Populations at Rockefeller University. His book is How Many People Can the Earth Support? I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bandleader, arranger, and baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan died Saturday at the age of 68. Coming up, we remember him with a 1989 interview. His compositions for Miles Davis helped usher in the era of cool jazz. With trumpeter Chet Baker, Mulligan developed the famous Pianoless Quartet. Also, Steve Weinberg reviews the new film, Georgia. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Jerry Mulligan, a great jazz innovator and perhaps the leading jazz baritone saxophonist of the last four decades, died Saturday at the age of 68. Mulligan made his mark as a composer and arranger with Gene Krupa's band and on the Miles Davis Birth of the Cool sessions. In the early 1950s, Mulligan moved from New York to the West Coast and formed a quartet with trumpeter Chet Baker. The group played a more temperate approach to bop that became known as cool jazz. Peter Watros of the New York Times remembered Mulligan as one of the great improvisers of post-war jazz. He wrote, "In his hands, the baritone saxophone, usually a burly, stiff creature, became supple and elegant. Wit played a large part in his improvisations, and in many of his solos, he added small riffs that sparkled, an odd quote or a sly melodic fillip that took his creations out of the realm of the ordinary." Terry Gross spoke with Jerry Mulligan in 1989 when he was expanding his work to include symphonic music, writing, and performing with the New York Philharmonic. Terry asked Jerry Mulligan how he approached writing music for classical musicians who aren't used to playing jazz.
What I tried to accomplish in my piece was writing something that the orchestra was comfortable playing. In other words, writing rhythmically in a way that was their idiom, not trying to force the orchestra to play the jazz idiom. The orchestra has its own ways of swinging, you know. The whole sense of momentum comes organically from the orchestra. They don't have a rhythm section. So producing that sense of momentum, you have to go about it in different ways. And there are ways that are the musical language that the orchestra is used to, and that's what I tried to call upon, not trying to impose a strange idiom on them. That's especially on the piece called Entente, because that's a solo piece with the orchestra. The other piece that we played is a piece for the quartet with the written with an orchestral arrangement. That, of course, presents another set of problems, because when you put a rhythm section with an orchestra, you run into acoustic problems that you don't run into otherwise. You know, the presence of drums and cymbals, for instance. Cymbals have a tendency to ring in just the registers that are already occupied by the strings and woodwinds and tend to wipe them out. So each of these things presents particular problems, and so you have to use logic to solve them.
Well, let me play an excerpt of the Entente for baritone saxophone and orchestra. It's one of the pieces you'll be playing with the New York Philharmonic, and you recorded it a couple of years ago on an album called Symphonic Dreams,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which features you along with the Houston Symphony conducted by Eric Kunzel. Mm-hmm. So this is the Entente. ¶¶ The Entente for baritone saxophone and orchestra, composed and arranged by my guest Jerry Mulligan, and this is one of the pieces he's performing in a series of concerts with the New York Philharmonic. Let's go backwards a little bit. You went on the road when you were a teenager. Was this against your parents' wishes, or did they think that that was okay?
Well, I think my parents accepted it as inevitable, and so they didn't stand in my way. I actually left high school to go on the road as an arranger with a band. And since that's what I wanted to do, and there was really no opportunity for me to go to music school, I insisted, and I got my way.
As you say, you went on the road as an arranger. One of your early arranging jobs was with the Gene Krupa band.
Mm-hmm.
Were you playing at all in the band at the beginning?
Not in the beginning, no. What happened, because because I was a saxophone player and I always had at least one horn with me, if somebody got sick or somebody left unexpectedly, I would get called into service to help out. So that happened a couple of times during the year that I was with Gene Krupa's band. And it was a good experience because they were wonderful players in the band. I learned a great deal, but I felt like I was in deep water because I didn't feel that I was half the saxophone player that those other men were.
In the late 40s, you teamed up with arranger Gil Evans for what became one of the key recording sessions of modern jazz, the sessions that became known as the Birth of the Cool, mm-hmm. with Miles Davis and the Nonet. How did you and Evans first get together for these sessions?
Well, being an arranger with the band, I met the arrangers for all the other bands, and there was always a kind of a sense of camaraderie between the arrangers. That's separate from the other players. And I became very close with Gil. I loved the way he wrote. That Thornhill band had a very orchestral approach because Claude Thornhill himself was a pianist whose whole approach was very Debussy-like. He loved the French Impressionists, and he gave that kind of aura to the band, the way the things were orchestrated and the use of French horns and clarinets in the ensemble was quite unique at that time.
When you were writing for the Nonet, did you see that as a compromise between a big band and a small group?
Well, it's I suppose compromise is a word. We never thought of it as a compromise. What we were looking for was a vehicle that would give us the kind of rhythmic freedom that you have with a small group, with something of the orchestral colors that you have with the large ensemble. And what we wound up with there was a really kind of a basic cut down in size version of the Thornhill band. And having the six horns gave us a tremendous sense of ensemble.
Let's hear something from The Birth of the Cool. This is Giroux, composed and arranged by my guest baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
Thank you.
We're listening to a 1989 interview Terry Gross did with jazz saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, who died this past Saturday. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to a 1989 interview with saxophonist Jerry Mulligan.
In the early 1950s, you moved to the West Coast. What brought you there?
Well, things were pretty rough in New York at that point. There were the places to work got fewer and fewer, and it was hard to make a living here. And the big bands that I had depended on to make a living was starting to die out. You know, the economy changed, and so I left New York and went to California to look for the land of opportunity.
And what you found there was trumpeter Chet Baker. And you formed a quartet with him that ended up being the kind of seminal band that would define the sound that became known as the West Coast Sound or cool jazz. Tell me how you teamed up with Baker.
Well, when I went to California, I first started out through friends writing arrangements for Stan Kenton's band. And I used to spend a lot of time going around to jam sessions all over the Los Angeles area. And I encountered Chet a few times at sessions, and I liked very much the way he played. He had a very melodic approach, and he was a wonderful player. And so when it came time to put together something to take into a club to go to work, I finally wound up, settled on this instrumentation with Chet. And so it was just a thing of proximity and opportunity, and it turned out to be the land of opportunity.
One of the things that distinguished your quartet was that it was a modern jazz group that didn't have a piano. Why didn't you have one?
Well, there were a couple of reasons for that, but the main reason was that the club we went into was a little place called The Hague in near downtown Los Angeles. When I first was playing on the off nights at this club, the main attraction in the club was Errol Garner. They had this beautiful concert grand piano on the stage. Well, the group following Errol was the trio of Red Norvo. Well, Red's instrumentation was, played the vibraphone, and he had a guitarist and a bass player. I think Charlie Mingus was with him then. And so they took this beautiful big grand piano out, and so I was going to play on the off nights. They said, well, they'll bring in a little upright. I said, no, you won't. So they go from this beautiful grand to upright, I won't do it. So I said, I'll put together a group that doesn't need a piano. And so it allowed me to put into practice something that we'd already tried in New York, rhythm section without a piano. And it worked very well.
Well, let me play something from your quartet with Chet Baker. This is a 1953 recording. It's your composition called Line for Lions. Thank you. My guest, Jerry Mulligan, with Chet Baker, their recording of Line for Lions from 1953. Well, while you were in the West Coast, you actually spent 3.5 months in a California prison on drug charges. You had been, you'd become addicted to heroin, as many of the jazz musicians of that time had become. What kind of prison were you in, and what was your life like while you were there?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant. And as far as prisons go, I suppose it wasn't very difficult because it was, I guess, a medium security compound out in the country north of Los Angeles. And some of the people in the prison, the guards and the wardens and all that, were very nice, and some were terrible. And they had, as I suppose they usually do, they had the people who were in there for various narcotics possessions were kind of kept together, and so it was, it could have been a lot worse. And the funny thing was, as soon as I got there, it turns out that the people who were involved in the prison work of called the care and treatment, they had the big battle going between the people said the prison is for punishment and the other people saying, well, prison is for rehabilitation. And these people are always fighting with each other to get the upper hand, you know. Well, I no more than arrived in this place, and the care and treatment people came up and said, would you write a Christmas show for us? Said, sure. Well, that created a great deal of resentment with the people who thought that I was supposed to be being punished. And I found myself having a very hard time with some of the guards who were, kind of the traditional sadistic types.
Huh.
And so it's kind of a pulling match between one and the other. And, I wound up putting a little band together and writing music for them, but wound up never doing the show because an organization called Narcotics Anonymous got a hold of a good lawyer. I had been very unlucky in the choice of lawyer. He was just a stupid man. I found out later that a lot of people that he had represented used to do things like put sugar in his gas tank and various things because he was such a rotten person. And it was very bad luck to wind up with somebody. Well, anyway, this organization and friends managed to get a rehearing, and they modified my sentence to time served and let me out. It was kind of a thing right out of a movie. It was, I think, the day or two before Christmas, and they took me into the down into the city to go to the court to have this hearing. And I think that the bus or the car that I was in to go down there got stuck in traffic, so by the time we got there, the hearing was already over, and I had been released. And it must have totally stunned the other people that I was in prison with, because they said nobody gets modified on a short sentence. It was a 6-month sentence to begin with. And so that was amazing. So the day before Christmas, I was released.
I want to ask you about a story that Nat Hentoff told in a New Yorker profile of you years ago. And he told the story of how when you were arranging with the Gene Krupa band, and this was in the 1940s, you were very young, one night, on the bandstand with the audience there, you started chewing out the band for being sloppy and telling Krupa that, he was irresponsible for allowing that sloppiness to happen. Pretty nervy for a young musician.
Yes, but I did not tell Gene Krupa off for allowing it to happen.
Oh, okay.
But what happened was, it wasn't a night in New York. We had a long plane trip into Atlantic City, New Jersey, or someplace, and we were playing in the afternoon. And it's a thing that's always kind of amazed me about myself is that I was a terrible sideman, because I was always, I kind of elected myself the conscience, the musical conscience of the band. And you do things like that when you're young. You're idealistic and so on. But I didn't learn how to be a good sideman in a band until after I'd been a leader and realized what you really should contribute. I didn't know how to contribute to the organization in terms of attitude. And so I was kind of a bristly person in that way.
So maybe you don't have the temperament to be a sideman.
That's true.
Maybe you have to be a leader.
Well, I think that's right. There are a lot of things about being a sideman that are so far from my personality. I could never be a studio musician to play music and learn it and play it once and that's the end of it. Music is to me something that has to live every day. And when I play a piece of music that I like, I want to play it a lot. I don't want to just play it once. So, I think you're right. There's a little bit of a personality problem there to be a success playing with a band.
Well, Jerry Mulligan, I thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Terry Gross spoke with Jerry Mulligan in 1989. Mulligan died on Saturday at the age of 68. Coming up, a review of the new film, Georgia. This is Fresh Air. In the new film, Georgia, Jennifer Jason Leigh plays an unstable woman who's struggling to establish a singing career. She's also struggling with the specter of her sister, Georgia, who's successful both on stage and off. Guest critic Steve Weinberg has this review.
The odd, jarring rhythms of the new movie, Georgia, are seductive at first. Much of the film is set in low-rent clubs and seedy motels, the temporary venues of musicians struggling to keep afloat. And the director, Ulu Grosbard, tries to reproduce the feel of that scrambling life, where time hangs heavy and days seem to have no shape. You can appreciate a filmmaker who resists slicking up a backstage rock and roll story like this one, and a photographer, Jan Kieser, who searches for the bluesy poetry in those sterile settings. But the film itself is shapeless, and it ODs on that somber red-eye mood. And it's impossible to go for authenticity when the dialogue is inauthentic. Georgia is the story of two sisters in the music business. Georgia, played by Mare Winningham, is gifted at a kind of soulful, country-flavored folk. She has a huge following, and she works hard to maintain a stable family life. Sadie, Jennifer Jason Leigh, is still drifting around the jagged edges of the music business, singing backup in unknown bands when her drinking and drug habit doesn't get in the way. Sadie's all affect. She wears gobs of eye makeup and paints black spider webs on her hands, and on stage she goes for broke in that histrionic Janis Joplin way. But she's not Joplin. She's not talented. So she lives in her sister's shadow, which she both resents and huddles in for protection.
My sister's here tonight, everybody. And we're going to do one of her songs. You want to come up and do it with us, Georgia? My sister.
miss when I'm leaving this earth.
What am I supposed to do with happy times I have in my head? Send them off to purgatory, thoroughly confused.
Maybe they could meet some old acquaintances or plans, and we could have a drink together, reminiscing, missing you.
If I wanted, I could
scrap you.
If I wanted, get back.
There's something perverse about a movie that presents you with two musical sisters and then focuses on the untalented one. In one scene, at an AIDS benefit where Georgia gives her a spot, Sadie covers Van Morrison's Take Me Back, and her misguided attempt to emulate Morrison's inimitable style gets embarrassing. Georgia has to steal in at the end to anchor the number and rock it to a close. And though, unlike Sadie, Jennifer Jason Leigh does have talent, here she repeats Sadie's mistake of confusing psychodrama with some kind of artistic truth. Winningham's acting has a layered purity that draws you. You want to watch her, and Rachel Rasko as her quiet, alert daughter, and in a few scenes, Max Perlich as Sadie's devoted groupie husband, whom she wears down. The biggest problem with Georgia is that, on stage and off, you don't want to watch Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowain.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.